sermon today as part of our mission of the message of Bound to Live. I want to mention a couple of things as we go into that. And one of those is that I'm really proud of Robin and Dorothy for stepping up to do a sermon as part of our series right now, and for joining for a topic that can be a little bit difficult. They'll be sharing some stories of their own experience that have been hard for them to go through, but that they are survivors, they are strong, God has walked with them, and I'm really proud for all the things they're going to be sharing, both in personal story, but also in their insight and theology that goes with that. I think that one of the things that is worth acknowledging when we recognize these types of seasons and these types of issues is that the church has not always been great at these issues. We have allowed abuse to happen in churches. We have not always done the best job of speaking up the way that we probably should have. And so it's important for any local church to know that these types of things are important. And so it's good that within our community, we are making sure that we bring this to the forefront, we wrestle with that together, we figure out how to be God's people, especially knowing that it's a hard thing, and sometimes the church at large has not always done the best job with that. So I'm really proud for them to be helping us do that together as our local community. Knowing also that some of these stories might be hard, it's okay if you say, I need to take a step back. That this is hard for me here. Maybe it's driven by memories or experiences that I've had or a loved one has had. So no one will think anything if you decide you need to step out for me or anything else like that. Please feel free to handle this as works best for you. But again, I'm really, really thankful and proud that this is something that we'll be doing together in worship today. So I invite you both up. Rob, I'm going to give you this. And Corey, can we get on mic too? Since we're getting buzzed early.
Lot's daughters, Dinah, Rachel and Leah, and the concubine of Judges 19. And there are so many more than these. Then there are also texts that demand that a wife submit to her husband, like Ephesians 5:24, Titus 2:4-5, 1 Timothy 2:11-15, and even more of those. Next, there's Leviticus and how women who give birth to daughters are unclean for twice as long as men who give, or as women who give birth to men, or to sons, I'm sorry. And finally, all throughout the Old Testament, prophets compare Israel to an unfaithful wife who deserves punishment. This all contributes to women being seen as less importantly than men. From the beginning, people in positions of power have used biblical texts to exercise control and power over those who did not have power. So it may seem usable or even correct when theologians like the great Tertullian, who died in 220 AD, said, "You women are the devil's gateway." Or how about St. Augustine, who's famous for a life of debauchery before committing himself to God, who says, "I cannot work out what help a wife could have been made to provide man with if you take away the purpose of childbearing." Yet these theological interpretations are in direct conflict with other messages of the Bible. Throughout the Bible, God opposes people who hoard authority and power over others. So how do we begin to reconsider these interpretations that lead to power and authority being used against women and others in positions of oppression? We can begin by entering into conversation with the text, especially when it gives power and authority to ourselves or to a select few. Both the Old and New Testament encourage us to make sacrifices, to avoid selfishness, and to give to others. When we interpret a text to encourage otherwise, we might consider that there may have been additional ways to interpret that text. Next, the Bible deals with some very problematic cultural dynamics from the biblical time. We may want to consider if those cultural contexts still apply even today when interpreting text. For example, Exodus 23:12 says that we are to work 6 days and rest on the seventh so that our ox, donkey, and slaves may rest. I'm going to dare to say that no one here today uses that passage to justify slavery. Nor do I think you're all going to go home and turn in your cars for donkeys. And furthermore, I'm guessing that no one is going to go to their boss tomorrow and say, "Gee, Joe, it was brought to my attention yesterday in church that I'm really only entitled to 1 day off a week. So I'm going to be coming in on Saturdays from now on, and by the way, that's all on me. You don't owe me any money." Cultures change over time, and we want to consider how Scripture applies to our culture. Lastly, there are Scriptures which theologians consider to be foundational texts. In addition to the stories within each book, and the histories that span the books, and even the messages within each of the testaments, there is this overarching story that begins in the Old Testament and that ends in the New Testament. And that story is a story of God's love for and his desire to be in relationship with humanity. Texts that create the foundation of that story are foundational texts. They create a basis for understanding God's love and plan for us, his creation, and his children. God does not do things coincidentally or without purpose. So when God tells us something straight up, right from the beginning, it's something we need to pay attention to. So, when God places a message about gender right at the beginning, in the first two chapters of Genesis, the first book of the Bible. At the beginning of creation, we need to look closely, listen, and attempt to understand all of the message. Genesis 1:26-31 and 2:18-24 are God's first words about gender, and they are foundational texts. Genesis 1:27 says, "So God created mankind in his own image, and in his own image he created them. Male and female, he created them." It's important to understand that the original writer identifies both male and female as being in God's image. Theologians place a great deal of importance on the fact that both the Old Testament and the New Testament interpret long-held, reinterpret long-held cultural beliefs of people and nations that lived in the areas surrounding the Hebrew people during the biblical times. And I believe theologians are right to make these observations. The Old Testament and New Testament are liberating the Hebrew people and labor for the Gentiles. And it is one of the reasons why early church leaders were able to convert so many followers in early church history. The idea of being made in God's image is not a new idea for the Hebrew culture or to the cultures of any of the Middle East. Many of the cultures in the ancient Middle East believed that the male rulers of the nations were indeed made in their God's image. But they believed only that the rulers who held power and authority over others were made in God's image, no one else. Not other men, not women, and not children. So it's truly remarkable that ancient Hebrew culture was progressive enough to conceive that all people were made in God's image, both male and female, and that he affirms them both as being sacred in Genesis 1 and 2. If we look at Genesis 2:18-24, we see that according to previous interpretations, Eve is made second, and her purpose is to be a helper to Adam. Both of these are true, but they are also incomplete. First, Eve is indeed made second, but to imply that second somehow is less is to ignore God's preference for what often does come second. He prefers Abel over Cain, Isaac over Ishmael, Jacob over Esau, Rachel over Leah, Joseph over all of his other servants. Eve is not an afterthought. She is the crown of his creation. And as for Eve being a helper, this too is true. The Hebrew word used to describe Eve as a helper is Esther, and it is typically used in the Bible to describe God as a helper to humanity. It describes God's relationship with the Hebrew people and how we should look to him as a clear and present help. It is not used to describe farm animals, slaves, assistants, or even other humans in general. Finally, while Eve is often blamed for causing sin in the world, that interpretation ignores Genesis 3:6, which says that Adam was with Eve and he ate it. If we consider that Adam is interpreted as humanity and Eve as light, we might cast the question, does the story of Adam and Eve have more to do with the communal nature of sin than it does in blaming Eve for sin? In fact, the Old Testament texts blame Hebrew people's insatiable worship of foreign idols for their separation from God over and over and over again, more than they ever blame Eve for it. We should not ignore that the first words spoken by a human are Adam speaking about Eve. Of all the things Adam has been shown by God, and he chooses first to speak about Eve. In Genesis 2:23, he exalts Eve and poem, and he says, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh." It's so significant, those words, that they are part of the traditional Scottish Celtic Christian wedding ceremony. As a young woman, I struggled with the idea that I was created to be in a position subservient to men, especially when those men could be hurtful to me and people that I loved. And not just other women, or not just women, but other men and children too. Imagine how liberating it might be to learn that the Bible has more to say about women than that we are to here to serve men. Some of you probably don't have to imagine how it feels. You may already know that feeling of learning that you too were created in God's sacred image, and you too have value and worth, and give God a reason to be pleased with his work. Still, culturally, we ignore the full understanding of this critically important foundation text in favor of traditions that allow authority and power to be lorded over others. We must ask why. And I just want to take a moment to say again that if these stories of domestic violence are troubling for you or could be triggers for you, this might be the time you want to take to step away. Why does American culture find it acceptable that over 24 men and women, women and men, are raped, beaten, or stopped every minute? And those are just the reported numbers. This amounts to over 12 million a year. And since I have begun speaking, about 120 rapes have occurred. Before Dorothy and I are done, as many as 360 will have occurred. 120 of their lives have been changed for always. They will no longer feel safe, and they will feel forever fear, anxiety, and shame. They will suffer from trauma for years to come. And we're just talking about emotional pain, too. We haven't even started to talk about these things. Their stories are our stories. They're mine and Dorothy's, as well as all of us here today. Because these stories have become part of American culture, and we cannot deny that too, that they help to define who we are as a people today. This past summer, Dorothy came to me after services one Sunday and said, "I'd like to share my daughter's story with my church family." She, Georgiana, is a survivor of domestic violence. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, so I'd like to do it then. I asked if she would be willing to share Georgiana's story together with me, because I too have a story to tell. And we found that our stories are not all that different, nor are they different from too many other stories of violent physical and sexual abuse. 29%, roughly one-third of American women, and 10% of men will be physically abused and or raped at some point in their life. And again, these are just reported numbers. Especially, this is true of men, they do not report numbers, but this is also true of women as well. This means more than 3 out of every 10 women are victims of violent abuse. But in my own family, the statistics are much higher. I have one brother and 4 sisters and my mom. Of the 5 women, 80% are victims of violent domestic beating and rape, all at the hands of my father or their spouse or significant other. I am the only one who has not experienced this form of violent physical abuse. But we are lucky because each of them survived it. I cannot begin to cover all the staggering statistics on domestic violence, but we know abuse harmfully impacts people beyond the victims of the abuse themselves. For example, witnessing abuse can have a devastating impact on children, even if they themselves are never hit. Children witnessing domestic violence within the home will suffer both short-term and long-term effects, including post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. When we consider this sobering information on domestic violence, we can count that both my brother and I are also survivors. And one of the least difficult stories to tell or to hear My oldest sister intervened on my mother's behalf during a ramp stage of physical violence prior to her birth. But unable to stop the blows, she ended up taking them from my mother, and that was a common occurrence. My brother and sisters intervened on numerous occasions as teens, but in our case, they were also recipients of abuse and blows. Of every 10 women injured due to domestic violence, only about 3 to 4 will receive medical treatment. Medical treatment includes treatment for physical injuries as well as mental health treatment. Why only 10%? Shame has some part in it. As a society, we create an environment where they are shamed as victims, so it's easier to keep it hidden than to be subjected to additional shame. But it's also because the abuser will not allow it in many cases. My mother never once received treatment. Domestic violence hotlines in the U.S. receive over 20,000 calls a day from victims in every year of their lives. When guns are available to the abuser, the victim is 500 times more likely to be killed. About 100 women are killed each month by a domestic violence partner. In August of 2016, one of them was my niece, Tara, who is 3 years older than my daughter, Zoe, that we met last week. Friends, if you leave here with nothing else, then I'm going to say the names. They are real people with real hopes and real dreams and real gifts that the world would be far better off with than without. So always allow the victims their names. Everything else is taken away from them. My brother would want you to know that Tara was a second grade teacher who had just finished her first year of teaching. And she spent her free time teaching dance to young girls and boys at the local dance center. Tara lost her life when a boyfriend she had broken up with a few months earlier concocted a plan to murder her new boyfriend and to injure her. He had stopped her from the beginning of the breakup, and as evidence they found later, he had researched how to injure her so that he could control her by making her permanently weak. After approaching her car from behind and shooting her boyfriend point blank, who immediately died in the back of the head, he rounded the car and shot her also in the back of the head while she screamed and pleaded for help. She died several hours later without my brother and his wife ever being notified that she'd been brought into the emergency room. It's important to note that Tara's abuser and murderer did not do this out of love or jealousy or any romantic notion. He wanted to control her, as all abusers do. And they will do and use whatever they need to acquire and maintain that control. It begins verbally with taking away someone's self-confidence and playing on their fears and anxieties, and escalates to rules and limitations on family and friends, and move into physical abuse, which can include the use of drugs and weapons to maintain that control. Dorothy's daughter, thankfully, survived her ordeal, but not without permanent scars from a man who wanted to control and work his power and authority over her as well.
Good morning.
Good morning, everybody.
My church family, my sisters and my brothers. I just want to let you know that I have 3 children. 2 James, the oldest, who I'm the oldest of Carolus and still is Carolus. She was a registered nurse. Imagine that, a registered nurse. She ran a hospital. My son, this was a soldier. He fought in Iraq. And Becky is my aunt who is a teacher. So if I was a mother, I should be proud, right? I am. I'm so proud of all three of them. So here's, be patient with me. Everybody in this church makes mistakes. Everybody. Good, bad, indifferent. Nobody I know doesn't say the wrong thing, whisper something in which they didn't have to. But it's still, you know, you can say, the wrong thing and regret it later. You can never take it back. So that's the beginning of my sermon. This story is about my daughter Georgiana. My daughter Georgiana, at 18, got pregnant. She decided to keep the baby and not to marry the baby's father. He did not want anything to do with the baby. Then she was forced on getting her life together, not only for her, but her daughter, and she went to college. She was one of the top students in her class. She received a nursing degree. She got a job as a nurse at a local hospital. And by the age of 28, she became the head nurse in the hospital. As a mother, this made me very proud. I saw that she was doing well. It was hard for her, but that's okay. She took a step back and became a nurse in the post-operatory recovery. So excited about my daughter becoming a nurse and helping other people. At the same time, her first husband was verbally abusive. They broke up, and then she met someone else. She married him, and he was the worst than the first. He was very verbally and physically abusive. He would get into fights with her. He broke her eye socket first. Then punctured her eardrum another time. And the third time, her neck, which has an operation on it and was put a rod. Why didn't she leave? When you are being abused, the people put you down and keep you down and say, I believe that. You aren't worth. Sorry. Her husband would say, you aren't worth anything. No one else will want you. Nothing but dirt. One day when she was in pain, he introduced heroin to her. That's when she became a donor. He said, this will take care of your pain. You don't need to go to the doctors. Maybe you should show up. And she did. And he did. That's when Georgiana became an addict. There was nothing anyone could do. That's when she became an addict to heroin. I know nothing about this. When I found out about it, I tried to convince her to come to Cool Mountains. I kept reaching out to her. She would ask for money, and a few times they gave it to her. That's what mothers do, don't they? Trying to help their kids, thinking that that's the way to do it. One time, she said, I put a chicken out of the dumpster. It was full of magnets. And she needed money for food. I guess she must think I'm horrible. Because at that time, I said no. I had to be strong for her. She was going to use them as drugs. I kept on praying, and my church family prayed with me. Ask the Lord, bring her to me. Finally, when the man was there and was overdosed on the floor, she reached out to me and was desperate. That's when the Lord sent her to me. She was alive with me. She lived, she lived with me for a year and a half and has been clean ever since. The abuse has left her scarred physically and mentally. As you can see, she's still in a wheelchair. At times, it's horrible nightmares where she can't move and she screams for me. She's getting help for her addiction and physical and mental abuse. Thinking of abuse and awareness, Mom, there are three things I have learned and want to share with you. John 8:7. When they kept questioning him to stone, when God will he straighten up, and he said to them, that any one of you without the first sin for the first stone at her. Everyone deserves help. It's easy to judge people, especially abuse victims and people who are abusing substance. Keep praying for the loved ones, God, and redeem their stories. Don't give up. Don't ever give up on your kids or people that have abuse. They need help. I'm not saying you give them money. I'm just saying pray for them and try to help them in different ways. In abuse situation, remember who's the victim. And recognize they feel trapped. They feel that they can't get out. They feel like there's scum or dirt or anything else. They have no feelings for themselves except for being abused and feeling hushed. Please, dear Lord, help me. But they can't get out of this situation because they don't even feel like that they could go to the grocery store or talk to another woman because they're not but some. Please don't think of abused people that you do know the time. Thank you.
So these are horrific, terrifying, and gut-wrenching stories for Dorothy and I, and probably at least hard for all of you to hear, but there is one last question to be asked, and I do think that there's hope here. How do we as Christians respond to domestic violence? I think Dorothy's scripture choice of John 8 provides us with a vision of what our responses can be and do for others. In John 8, a woman caught in adultery is brought to Jesus by the Pharisees and thrown on the floor. They demand that Jesus tell them what to do with her because the Mosaic law requires that she be stoned. Jesus says, "Let he who has not sinned cast the first stone." Many choose to focus on the text using the interpretation that Jesus has forgiven the woman who deserves to be punished. But this interpretation misses a few things. First, it's important to acknowledge that while there is a woman caught in adultery, the man is nowhere to be found. He's not accused. We must understand that women had no control over their own bodies in Roman culture. A woman could not say, no, it was not required that women would consent. And men were never held accountable for abuse.
or made a little bit more, was it ever considered use for that?
Finally, as the Pharisees bring them to the end, they offer him a thing to respect in the way they treat them. Jesus recognizes our fears and challenges them by saying, let him without fear cast the first stone. But he is also challenging the boys' network, the boys with the boys' mentality. He doesn't ask the woman, why did you agitate your abuser? He doesn't ask her, what did you do to make him do this to you? Why did you wear that? Why did you go alone? Why didn't you leave? Instead, Jesus recognizes that both culturally and specifically to her situation, there are things that were beyond her control, and Jesus accepts and liberates her. He frees her, and he turns the tables on the accusers. He refuses to allow the woman to be blamed and shamed for the abuse she has been victimized by, and instead lifts her to a place of equality, and invites all of them to live a life free of sin. John 8, verses 3 through 11 help us see that none person is deserving of abuse, and that it is the abuser themselves who must be held accountable. Women, men, and children who are victims of domestic violence have no power and no authority to change their circumstances, regardless of any choice that they may or may not have made themselves. The abuser makes sure that they are groomed to be fearful of the abuser and to be distrustful of themselves and others. Domestic violence and rape are not about sex or romantic notions. They are about the abuser's exertion of power and authority over the victim. I don't know specifically what was going on in the house with my mom, Tara, or even Louisiana, but I know they were afraid. They felt they could not trust them. They felt they were undeserving of something better, or that they had caused this themselves. My sister often told me that my father would threaten to kill my mom if my brother and sister spoke of what was happening. I know Tara tried to leave, but felt shame for what was happening to her and never sought help from anyone. What if it were shameful to harm anything created by God or in God's image? What if we spoke for the sacredness of being children and men, all who are created in God's image? How might the world be different? Could we eradicate abuse? Maybe war? Maybe corporate greed? Maybe we would have better health care and education? It's really quite simple. PR people do this all the time. Look at how differently we feel today about fear than we did 50 years ago. What if we talked in the church differently about gender and treated it with the same sacredness as God created it with? One of my former professors writes this: God puts humanity and life, Adam and Eve, in the garden, and they must struggle with whether to eat the forbidden fruit.
I'm sorry.
In Moses' final sermon, he tells the people that they have a choice of life or death, prosperity or adversity, blessings or curses. The book of Proverbs describes God as setting two paths: the wise way of righteousness and the foolish way of the wicked. We have a moral choice to make. Will we use it for life, love, and all that is good, or will we use it for patriarchy, inequity, and the evil?
All right.
The Bible is a sacred text for all of us.
That paperwork and, put you
guys we
down
should ask
for,
questions in the stores of heart and see how we did from the other.
Yes, for a deposit.
The statistical theologian today writes this: do not abandon the Bible to the fetishers and the thinkers. Take back the text.
We've got plenty of those.
Do not let go until it blesses you. Indeed, make it work for a blessing, not for a curse, so that you and your descendants can be all the families of the earth.
there's 20 people in there decently comfortably before. Thank you.